This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. For tennis fans, what if you could pick the brains of the world's greatest players and coaches? Want to improve your serve? Get advice from Pete Sampras. Want to know how to hit the perfect ground stroke? Ask Tracy Austin. Tennis journalist and author Mark Hodgkinson has done all the hard work of gathering the best tips from the best of the tennis world, and he lays it all out in his new book, Game, Set, and Match, Secret Weapons of the World's Top Tennis Players. He joins us this afternoon. Hi, Mark. Good to have you here.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
It looks like this was really an extensive production to write this book. How did you go about pulling all this advice together?
Yeah, so I first had the idea. It must have been, it's probably now about 3 or 4 years ago, and I was doing an interview with Anna Kournikova, and I was asking her about her sort of tennis fame and how she dealt with celebrity. And, you know, she started to pass off a few tips. Like she was, you know, for example, she was saying, you know, if you want to avoid the paparazzi, don't put on a disguise or dark glasses. That only encourages them. And so I was sitting there talking to her and listening to what she was saying. And I thought it'd be really great to speak to the world's top players, or, you know, as many as I could, and all the top coaches, and ask them about parts of the game, so physical and technical and psychological, and, you know, so I've been very fortunate to speak to, you know, Serena and Venus Williams, to give a few names, Pete Sampras, Chris Evert, Navratilova, John Isner, Andy Murray, and, you know, so I hope that it's a fun book to read as well as informative.
How many players and coaches contributed to the book?
I would say in total, I probably did around 250 to 300 interviews. And I'd say of those interviews, probably about 200 made the book. And, you know, it was just a great privilege to, you know, to get the opportunity to speak to all these people. And, you know, players like sort of Sampras and Sharapova, and yeah, so it's taken a long time to put it together, but I hope people enjoy it.
And now, is this book aimed at just people who play the game?
No, I think primarily it is, but you know, but I also think if you don't necessarily play, but you're a tennis parent, and you know, if your young daughter or son is, you know, is taking interest in the sport and showing some promise. I've got some advice from Federer's mother, Lynette, and also from Richard Williams, who's the father of Venus and Serena and for other players, as well, Anna Ivanovic. So talking about all the, you know, all the pitfalls of being a tennis parent, because it's a fraught relationship. I think it can be dangerous if you get too involved with your child's tennis. And, you know, for example, Anna Ivanovic, she's a former world number one, former French Open champion. And she was talking about the fact that she thinks it's a very bad idea for any parent to coach their child. So that it's much more important to have that strong relationship away from the sport. And if you know, as a parent, if you start coaching your child at any high level, it just becomes problematic.
So you actually got to talk to Roger Federer's mother. That's pretty interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, so she was, yeah, you know, I've done a little bit of work a few years ago for Federer's Foundation, and I used to work for Telegraph a few years ago, paper in England, and it must have been probably about 10 years ago, and I went over there, yes, in 2005 to do some. I was doing some research on Federer's background, and I got in contact with her, and she passed me some photos. I think Roger, when he was the first time he played tennis, and first time he swung a racket. So I guess there was contact there already.
So it goes without saying, Mark, that kids are the future of this sport. How do you help your kids get the most out of their tennis?
One of the tips from, I guess the strong message coming through from Federer's mother and from Richard Williams and others is that primarily it's about fun. I think there's such a tiny proportion of people who play a lot as children or as teenagers go on to make it as professionals. So I think for a child to make the most of their game probably means, you know, being as happy as possible on the court.
I think even more important is the question: how do you avoid being a nightmare tennis parent?
Yeah, no, exactly. You know, so I spoke to a subject I spoke to Greg Rosensky about, and I think a lot of it is becoming sort of too involved. I think if you're always sort of hovering over your child and trying to make decisions for them, and also I think if your reaction to them, the way you speak to them, the way you're around them, is dependent on your child's results, then that's a big sort of warning sign. I think, you know, you should one piece of advice is almost not to watch your children's matches as much. I think if you're there sort of clinging onto the back fence, you know, sort of living every backhand, living every forehand, you know, that can become an issue. And it's, you know, it's probably better to take a step back, let your child's coach be much more involved.
Now you cover other aspects of the game besides techniques and strategies. One of those is the mental aspect of tennis. Now, how important is the mental part of such a physical game?
Well, I think, you know, if you look at the elite level, you know, there's obviously a difference in sort of talent and ability and, you know, sort of physical technique between, you know, guys like Djokovic and Federer and Murray and Nadal. People are at the top and people ranked about sort of 50. But I'd say probably the biggest difference is on the mental and psychological side. You know, if you're able to cope in those intense moments and also react to victory and defeat, that's how that's how you go on to win these big tournaments. And I also think if you sort of transfer that to your local club or your local park, I think I think so much of it is mental for amateurs as well. And so, you know, I was fortunate to speak to Sharapova about sort of being sort of mentally tough, and it's something she's become known for. And I think an interesting thing she said is that, you know, she travels with sort of a team of coaches and advisors and fitness consultants and whatever. But she was basically saying you can, you know, fundamentally you have to take responsibility for yourself at a sort of one-on-one sport. And you can surround yourself with a team of great people, but ultimately it's up to you. And it's up to you whether you win or lose.
We always look at tennis as being a polite, civilized sport, but is there a lot of players trying to get inside each other's heads and psych each other out for these games?
Yeah, I mean, I think probably the expert on this particular subject, a guy who loves talking about the sort of psychology of tennis, is Mats Wilander, a former Swedish player who's won Grand Slam tournaments and former world number one. And he was talking about the ability to get into an opponent's head. I think it's the small things, like, you know, if you're celebrating after a big point and you're doing a fist pump, you have to make sure your opponent sees that. And he said that there's no point to turning your back away from your opponent and he doesn't see it. You have to. He said that the whole time there's so much body language, which is, you know, it's been sort of spoken from one player to another. And it's about sort of sending out sort of strong signals down the court. Because, you know, as we were saying earlier, so much of the game is mental and psychological. So you can sort of wear your opponent down, not just by, you know, constantly sort of hitting winners past them, but sending out the signal you're there and you're going to fight until the end.
We're talking with Mark Hodgkinson. He's the author of Game, Set, and Match, Secret Weapons of the World's Top Tennis Players. And Mark, Pam Shriver talks about how you deal with an opponent who's grunting. Now, how common a complaint is that in tennis that your opponent grunts when he or she smacks the ball?
Well, I think it's a very common complaint. Well, not common, but it's something you hear quite a lot with people watching professional tennis. They sort of say, oh, I turned on the TV and I couldn't bear the grunting, so I had to turn it down or switch it off. And, you know, I guess it's been an issue in recent years with sort of Sharapova and Azarenka, who's a former world number one. But if you go back a few more years, Monica Seles, she's probably the first player who, you know, who's gone to attract a lot of attention. And so I've actually spoken to two people on this particular subject. So Monica Seles, how to cope when there are complaints about your grunting. and Pam Shriver on what to do if your opponent is grunting. And I think to talk about Sellers first. She was always saying that it wasn't gamesmanship. She wasn't trying to get an unfair advantage over her opponent by grunting. She just said it was something she had done from a young age, and it was only because, you know, she always said she did it when she was, you know, when she was ranked 200 in the world, no one really cared. She did it when she was world number one and winning slams as a teenager, and suddenly it was a big issue because obviously she was making out people so jealous of what she was achieving. But she said that, you know, as long as you know in your own mind, you're not trying to get an unfair advantage over an opponent. She sort of said she was comfortable with that. And on the flip side of Pam Shriver, she said, you know, you should always, if you are unhappy about it, and, you know, you should always complain to an official, sort of, and do it in a polite way. But she made an interesting point. You should try to issue your complaint when you're in a winning position, or when you just won a game, or you've broken serve, or whatever. Because I think if you do it after you've dropped your serve, or after you've lost a set, it can look like some sour grapes. So it's much better to do it. If you're winning the match, then you complain. I mean, it then doesn't look like you're whining about your opponent.
So when it comes to grunting, Mark, you've got both sides of the issue covered in the book, it sounds
yeah,
like.
Yeah, exactly. Everything you can want to know about grunting is all there in the book.
For those of us who play doubles, there's a lot of advice on picking a partner. I mean, how do you pick your partner?
Yeah, so in the doubles section, most amateurs, I guess, probably the majority of the tennis they're going to play is going to be doubles. And that's, you know, it's a very important decision who you're going to play with. And, so I've spoken to a variety of people in that section, including the Byron brothers, who are the most successful men's pairing in history, who won more than 100 titles. And, I guess a lot of it is down to your skills, and you need to look at potential partners and think, are my skills going to complement his or hers? And, you know, for example, if you've got a particularly good serve, you might want to play with someone who's strong at net, who can take advantage of, you know, of the opponent's returns. Obviously, if you've got a stronger serve, that they might be sort of looping the ball back and your partner can pick it off. But I think on top of that, I think it's very important that you enjoy playing with that person, because, I mean, fundamentally, it's meant to be an enjoyable activity. And I think if you're playing with someone whose skills complement yours, but there's no personal chemistry, it's not going to be great.
So it's a matter of finding someone you're comfortable with, and finding someone whose skills are a good offset or a good complement for your skills.
Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah, if you can find someone who fits the bill with both those things, that's great.
Now, you also cover getting started in wheelchair tennis. What's the message there?
Yeah, so I spoke to Esther Vergeer. She's a Dutch lady who's actually unbeaten for more than a decade. And, you know, arguably the most dominant athlete in the history of sport. And she was basically saying it's, you know, a lot of it's questions of actually getting out and having a go. Because I think she thinks a lot of disabled people aren't, don't have the inclination to, you know, to try. Maybe they're intimidated by the possibility of trying the game. And so, yeah, so her view is go out and give it a go, and she's fairly confident you'll enjoy it.
Now, one of my favorite sections deals with how to smash a tennis racket. Is that boorish behavior, or can this actually be a good thing for the sport?
I don't know. It's on. You often hear people sort of tussling about the bad behavior of these players. But I think people sort of enjoy being outraged. And, you know, I think especially in certain environments, such on sort of centre court at Wimbledon, it's seemingly such a refined and civilized place. It's sometimes nice to break that up a little bit with a bit of sort of raw anger. And, you know, so the guy I spoke to on this particular subject was a Russian player called Dmitry Tursunov. And he was quite so funny about it. And, you know, he was saying things like, you know, if you, there's no, there's no great skill breaking a racket on a hard court. That's fairly easy to do. But he was saying, you know, if you really want to show off, and you really want to show real talent for breaking rackets, you have to do it on a grass court.
On a grass court.
So obviously a little bit softer. And on a similar sort of subject, Goran Ivanišević, who won Wimbledon in 2001. He was a funny guy, and he was renowned for smashing rackets. And he spoke about how you sort of deal with all the, you know, all the emotions after breaking one. And he says, you know, often a player will break a racket and feel very guilty about it afterwards. But he sort of said it can be very sort of therapeutic. All your sort of emotion, all your anger and frustration goes into that one moment. He says then you basically have to forget about it almost immediately and then move on. But I suppose I would say I guess as a parent, you wouldn't. It's not something you'd want to encourage your child to be doing. These rackets are pretty expensive.
Yeah. Well, unless people think you're promoting bad behavior, you do offer a lot of advice on the book on how to be sporting, right?
Yeah, no, exactly. And also, I spoke to a guy called Andrew Jarrett. He's a referee at Wimbledon, and he's the guy you might see on your TV screen if there's any sort of issue of bad behavior, or, you know, if a player's involved in a long argument with an umpire or the line judge, Andrew Jarrett might come out on court during, on centre court or around the grounds. And I spoke to him about how to deal with, you know, the players having tantrums, and, you know, so I wouldn't want people to think I'm encouraging bad behaviour in the book. It is, you know, there's a lot of advice on there and diffusing anger as well.
Mark, what do you think is the future of tennis? How's it holding up when it comes to its popularity?
Well, I think on the men's side, I think most people would agree it's been a golden age over the last few years of Federer, Nadal, Djokovic, and Murray as well. And, you know, they produce some brilliant tennis. And, you know, some of the storylines and the matches have been pretty enthralling. But I suppose the one concern on the men's side would be, you know, once those players have left the stage, what's going to happen then? There's a new generation coming through. You know, players like Nick Kyrgios is an Australian guy. Borna Koric, he's Croatian. Grigor Dimitrov is Bulgarian. So, I mean, there is, obviously, it'd be very difficult to replicate, to replace people like Federer and Nadal, but there is, you know, there is some excitement about the players coming through. And on the women's side, Serena Williams is arguably the greatest female player of all time, and so it's been fascinating watching what she's doing. So she's, you know, she's in her mid 30s now. She's still around. Her older sister Venus is still competing as well, and, you know, they're not going to be around for that much longer, I guess. I suppose you could see Serena still, you know, if she continues to win Grand Slams and that's what motivates her, she might still be around into two, three years' time. But, you know, underneath that, I mean, Sharapova has been the top of the game for 10 years. So you know, it's been a fascinating time recently. But also on the women's side, younger players coming through. You know, Eugenie Bouchard, who's Canadian. I mean, she's had fairly average results recently, but, you know, she reached her first Grand Slam final at Wimbledon last year. So I guess same as the men's side. There's always, you know, always concerned about what's going to happen next. But, you know, there are some new names coming through.
But you think when it comes to the future of the game, it looks pretty bright.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I suppose it's the same with every generation. I guess if you go back to sort of times of McEnroe and Borg, people say, "Oh no, what's going to happen when they go?" And, you know, and then later with Sampras and Agassi, people say, "How will tennis survive?" But then Federer came along, and then Nadal came along, and so I think there's always going to be sort of new names and new storylines.
Thanks, Mark.
Pleasure. Thanks very much for having me on.
Tennis journalist Mark Hodgkinson. His new book is Game, Set, and Match: Secret Weapons of the World's Top Tennis Players.